WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This is a special early release of our podcast. This week in the New Yorker, we published an article by staff writer Jane Mayer about Christopher Steele, the former British intelligence officer who compiled the infamous Russian dossier on Donald Trump. Steele put the document together on contract for an opposition research company, but this wasn't the typical opposition research that candidates routinely do on each other. The dossier alleges a ring of corrupt ties between Trump and powerful Russians, so significant that Steele brought his information to the FBI. Jane, let's start with one point in your article that has gotten a lot of attention, and that is the idea that there's another Christopher Steele memo written after the election in which it's alleged that the Kremlin somehow tried to intervene and block Trump's initial choice for Secretary of State, Mitt Romney. Take us through that memo and how this allegation is supposed to have played out.
Right. So there is, it was the missing memo from Steele, and it was written at the very end of November 2016. And it's just, it's unusual for his memos because it's really short and it's only based on one source. And his source is just someone who's describing what the talk is in the Russian foreign ministry in November 2016. And what he says is that people there were claiming credit for trying to intervene and stop Trump from picking Mitt Romney as Secretary of State.
Well, how could they possibly have done that? In other words, there was a lot of opposition to Mitt Romney in the administration to the degree to which Kellyanne Conway went on television and spoke for the Republicans who were against somebody like Romney, who I guess they thought was too much of a globalist. So what did the Russians have to do with any of that?
Well, so it doesn't prove a thing. I mean, it's simply saying this is what they were talking about. And I suppose the reason it's interesting and, you know, maybe in some kind of far out way, possibly true, who knows, you know, you need a lot more information. But is that the sort of the situation surrounding it kind of fits the crazy conspiracy theory for a change. What happened was there was actually a very weird and prolonged kind of courtship of Romney. Trump was going it even for Trump, it was unusually strung out.
But a lot of people thought that was just a practice of humiliation. Romney had been very against Trump. He had talked about him in really derogatory terms during the campaign.
Right.
And it seemed, you know, in line with Trump's behavior that he would court him as a way to reject him and humiliate him.
Well, and we quote, we of course put that in the magazine as well, in order for people to be able to evaluate this on their own. But Roger Stone, for instance, talked about it as just a chance for Trump to torture Romney, because just for his own kind of enjoyment. That's possible. I mean, you know, and we certainly point that out in the story. And it's not as if Steele is saying he's putting his entire credibility on the line with this. He's saying this is what they were saying in Moscow in the foreign ministry at that point. And if you take a look at what happened, what's interesting is that, you know, Romney did eventually get rejected. And the choice was Rex Tillerson instead, who was kind of a surprise, and as we write, a happy surprise in Moscow at that point, because he had very warm and longstanding ties to the Russian government. He'd been at ExxonMobil, where they had done a huge oil deal with Rosneft, the Russian oil company.
So I wanted to get that point on the boards, but I really want to start from the beginning. Let's begin with, who is Christopher Steele? What's his experience, and why is he looking into any potential Russia-Trump relations in the first place?
So Christopher Steele is someone who spent most of his career at MI6 as a Russia area expert for the British intelligence service. He was there for over 20 years, and after that, he left in 2009 and set up his own small business selling intelligence to private clients. And his expertise was still in the area of Russia. He speaks the language fluently. And he's considered quite expert by most other people I interviewed in the area of post-Soviet Russia.
So who initially hired him to look into Donald Trump and Russia?
Fusion GPS, which is a Washington firm that provides intelligence also for pay to clients.
But in fact, wasn't there a Republican, Paul Singer, a finance guy who was very much in the establishment of the Republican Party, also interested in relationships between Trump and Russia as a way to, you know, combat the Trump candidacy early on?
Right. I mean, and this is one of the things that suggests there was kind of a bipartisan beginning to this whole research project. Fusion GPS first worked for Paul Singer through a corporation he set up that's called the Free Beacon. And so the first funding came from the right. It came from a Republican who was unhappy with Trump. And when it looked like Trump was going to get the nomination, Paul Singer dropped out, gave up. And Fusion GPS, which had been doing the research, had come across a number of really hot leads, they thought. And so they then went across town, got in touch with the Clinton campaign and said, would you like us to keep digging? We think we're coming up with some interesting stuff.
Is there anything sleazy about that? Is that just the way Washington works these days?
You know, I mean, I think it's the way a lot of the world works. I mean, these companies are not, they're not political. They are commercial enterprises, and they're going to work for almost anyone who will pay them to do the research. And so, they're not like journalists or political figures. They are just companies making a profit.
Jane, when was the last time that Christopher Steele set foot in Russia himself?
I think it was around 2009. So he has not been able to gather this information himself. He's had to set up a kind of a network that gathers the information for him.
Do you have any sense of who his sources in Russia are? What kind of people? How high?
Well, he describes them in kind of general terms in most of these reports. And so they range from everything from top former Kremlin officials and former FSB agents to people who worked in, for instance, the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Moscow. It seems to be a whole range of people.
And why do we trust him? Why, you know, your piece, if there's an overwhelming tone to it, it's one of that this guy has great credibility in intelligence circles, but also in government circles. Why do you trust him?
Well, I certainly wouldn't do it on blind faith. I mean, what this piece does is goes back and interviews people who've worked with him and known him really throughout his whole life and who know his whole record professionally. And it also talks to intelligence officials about the dossier and how it stands up over time. And what comes through in the reporting is he has an excellent reputation. He's considered a reliable source by the U.S. government, by both the intelligence agencies and the FBI, who've worked closely with him over the years. He's considered reliable by MI6, where he worked for over 20 years, and he's considered to be reliable by the clients who've hired him as his private business. And so he brings with him a sort of a sterling reputation, basically. And, you know, the dossier, I think you also have to understand what it is. And a lot of the intelligence people that I interviewed talked about it. If you're expecting it to be 100% accurate, I think you're going to be disappointed. And it's not expected by, I think, by Steele or his firm or by any of the people who understand what it is. What it is basically raw intelligence. It's conversations with well-informed sources who are saying what they're hearing. It hasn't been corroborated or cross-checked with other kinds of intelligence, which is what a finished intelligence report would be. It's just the first stage of an intelligence report.
Now, it's pointed out in the piece that Steele is in the position of being hated by both the president of Russia and the president of the United States, Putin and Trump. So give us a sense of what the last year has been like for Steele. And how do you know, by the way?
Well, it's been incredibly hard for him. Is the answer? He has talked to friends about how, you know, he hopes he'll look back in 5 years and laugh at this situation, but he's kind of a pessimist, and he basically says, "I think I'll take this to my grave. My life is never going to be the same," is what he tells people. And how do I know it? Well, one of the greatest sources in this story is his business partner, Christopher Burroughs, with whom he set up the business in 2009. It's a small shop, fewer than 10 employees. They work closely together every day. And Burroughs, for the first time, has really revealed what it's been like for them and told me what Steele's been saying. And so did many of Steele's old friends, because I got sort of the ability to talk to an awful lot of people who've known him over the years.
One of the things that Steele investigated in his career recently is the way that Litvinenko was poisoned to death by Soviet agents. At least that was the conclusion he came to, Alexander Litvinenko. In fact, there's no news of yet another Russian agent living in London who seems to be dying of poisoning, possibly by Russian infiltration. That suggests that Christopher Steele himself might be in great danger. Does Steele think that he is in mortal danger?
You know, he doesn't, from what I've heard, act like somebody who thinks he's in mortal danger. He did initially, when the news broke of who he is and that he was the author of this dossier, he fled with his family for about 8 weeks and went into hiding. But he's now back and walking the streets of London. He tries to keep a very low profile and just do his work.
Is he protected by British authorities?
He is not, no. And I think the theory that he has shared with his partner is that the Russians generally, you know, they may go after their own in places as far-flung as London, people who they regard as traitors, but they don't generally go after the opposing country's intelligence services.
Now, this piece is hardly a puff piece on Christopher Steele. You have people who are his critics, not only in the present tense, but when he was in college, and also people describe him as having a Marmite personality. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, he has a Marmite is this very sort of salty spread that the British put on toast sometimes. Either you love it or you hate it. And he has had that effect on people throughout his life. He's a very black and white person who has a very binary view of what's right and what's wrong and a very strong sense of this is my duty and I must do it. And, you know, some people find it to some extent kind of naive. And there's a quote in this story from one of the Americans who's gotten to know him, from Peter Fritsch, who works at Fusion, who said that, you know, he's got the mentality of a kind of a British civil servant who is just kind of naive about what politics is like. And so he was kind of shocked to be attacked in the way he has in America.
But wait a minute. How naive could he be? This guy was on the Russia desk for years. He was an agent on the ground in Moscow for 3 or 4 years at the height of the Soviet collapse and the onset of the Yeltsin regime. I mean, how naive about politics could he be?
Well, I think he's not naive about Russia. In fact, he has an incredibly dark view of Russia that was formed partly by that Litvinenko murder, but and many other things that he's seen. I think you really couldn't get a darker view of Russia than he has. But I think he had a somewhat maybe overly optimistic view of the West by comparison. So he thinks he's working, you know, at one point, one of the people he talked to said that he would sort of describe the goodies versus the baddies. And the baddies were the Russians and the goodies were the West with, which included, in his view, the United States. And he'd worked long to work closely with the United States for something like 30 years, practically, both first in the government and then afterwards. And so, because he's worked a lot with the FBI. And so I think when I say he's naive, what I mean is he sort of had a view of the U.S. government as being somewhat enlightened and not necessarily throwing somebody like Christopher Steele under the bus in order to sort of push their partisan political agenda.
So there's an amazing moment in your piece, Jane, when Glenn Simpson, who's one of the co-founders of Fusion GPS, the firm that Steele was working for and doing the investigation for, and Simpson said in congressional testimony that, quote, "We threw a line in the water and Moby Dick came back." Did Steele know what he was getting himself into when he decided to look into Trump's connection to Russia, and when they did bring Moby Dick back, what did he do next?
Well, and this is, to me, one of the major moments in the story, too. What's so interesting is that he didn't even think really about what he was getting himself into in the beginning. And there's a quote from a very old friend of his who says, it's not so much that he sticks his head in the oven is that he doesn't see the oven. And again, this is a sort of...
What does that mean?
It's like he's a little blinkered. He's doing his duty. He's gonna go get the information he's been asked to get and just charge ahead, because that's what he's supposed to do. So he goes ahead, he gets this information, he thinks it's going to be an assignment to look into just, a few sort of ordinary dodgy business deals involving Trump and Russia. And his network is tasked to bring back what they can find. And lo and behold, what comes back is utterly shocking.
So what is shocking? We know, let's not kid around here, the one indelible piece of business in the dossier, which was eventually published by BuzzFeed, was that Trump at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in his room at the presidential suite allegedly had paid prostitutes to urinate on the bed, both for whatever fun that brings you and also to defile the very bed that President Obama and his wife had slept in earlier. It seems like a fantastical tale, but who knows? Life is full of fantastical realities. But the dossier and the many memos that comprise it have many other details. What are the most salient ones? What are the most believable and what are the most problematic for the Trump administration?
Well, so I have to say, taking what you're saying about this particular situation in the Ritz-Carlton hotel in Moscow, to Steele, what he's looking at is not just the act itself, but what was shocking was something that sounded like a crazy espionage movie, which is the possibility that a future president of the United States could be blackmailed. And that's what catches his attention more than anything, is that maybe Trump is compromised by them and that they have some kind of leverage over him, and that could possibly explain a lot of the pro-Russian positions that Trump is taking. And Steele, who regards Russia as the enemy of all enemies, is thinking, oh my God, what does this mean for the Western alliance? What does it mean for the United States? What does it mean for NATO? He's looking at these this sort of larger picture, and so that one act to him signifies quite a bit more. What he's also looking at is that the first report comes. It's written up in the end of June in 2016 by him, and it also looks at. What he says is his sources say is at least a 5-year courtship by the Russians of Trump, and that they have a sort of this relationship going back over years where the Russians are feeding Trump and the people around him intelligence that on his opponents, including Hillary Clinton, and offering dirt on her in particular, and that they're backing Trump in the election in particular, and that they're going to try to do this in exchange for eventually trying to get some policy changes that they want from the United States, including lifting sanctions.
Now, this didn't just stay with Fusion GPS. Why did it get to the FBI? Why did Christopher Steele, who's working for Fusion GPS as a private investigator and, as you describe it, kind of free enterprise slash political piece of business, goes to the FBI? What business did he have doing that? Why did he do that? And how did he do it?
So this has been something that's been misportrayed by Trump's defenders, basically. They claim that what Steele was trying to do was take opposition research that was phony to begin with and start an FBI investigation into Trump in order to blacken his name. What was the reality? Well, the reality is that from what I've been able to tell from my reporting, he went to the FBI because he felt a sense of duty. He's been in government for many years, and when he set up his private business with his partner, they had an agreement that if they ever came across any kind of information that had a national security dimension, they would alert the authorities. They felt it was a responsibility they had. And they'd done it several times in the past, having to do with things having to do with terrorism and other issues. And Steele had worked with the FBI on many cases in the past, so he had friends there. So when he came across this information that he thought was possibly just explosive about Trump, he thought, I better alert the American authorities.
So just to be clear, the funding for Steele's work, which is controversial, that all came from private sources, right? But he then brought the results of his investigation to the FBI out of a sense of national security. Am I getting it right?
That's right. And he was not paid by the FBI. He did this voluntarily. He did it for free. And he did it out of a sense of duty that he'd acted on in many times in the past. So this wasn't an aberration really for him. It was kind of a continuum of things he'd done in the past.
So he gives this dossier to the FBI in 2016 in July. How did the FBI react? Was the FBI already looking into Trump themselves?
So he doesn't actually give them the dossier. He just does a briefing on July 5th, 2016. One of the FBI agents he knows comes by his office in London. And apparently the reaction, Steele has said elsewhere, was shock and horror. It was like, oh, my God, what are we going to do with this? So that was the initial reaction, but it seemed like as the weeks went on, the FBI really didn't do much
about it. Was James Comey himself, who was still running the FBI, if I'm getting my dates right, was he briefed on it himself?
Who knows? I mean, that's the very top of the FBI. This is one agent, you know, way down on the ground. And my guess is there was a large gap between the two. And they were, you know, and the FBI was a little slow off the mark. I was told it was summertime. People are on vacation. Meanwhile,
wait a minute. Are you kidding me? The FBI didn't brief anybody because people were in Cape Cod or the Jersey Shore?
It just kind of moseyed along, okay? And they, meanwhile, were getting some a little bit of other information. They were following one person in the Trump inner circle, a foreign policy advisor named Carter Page, who had popped up in Moscow on July 7th, right around the same time that Steele went to the FBI, and gave a speech that was very sort of eye-catchingly pro-Russian, anti-Trump U.S. in terms of anti-U.S. in terms of the policy that the Obama administration had. It was saying that Putin need to be given sort of more leeway to do the things that he wanted to do.
So the FBI initially doesn't react in the summer of 2016. Weeks go by. And at this point, Steele and his colleagues at Fusion GPS decide that they're going to try to get some of this information out through other means. And you, among others, were involved. Tell us that story.
Right. So I got a call saying I had written a little bit about the Russia story, and I got this kind of mysterious call saying, would you like to meet with a Russian expert? We can't give you his name, but he's going to be over at the Tabard Inn near DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., and meet us at a certain point. So I thought, well, that's intriguing. So, of course, so I went over.
And it's close to the office, so it's not inconvenient.
It's close to the office, and the food's really good there. And so I walk in, and right around a table in a private dining room are people from Fusion GPS and this British man who is... turns out to be Christopher Steele. And we were told we were not allowed to use his name, we reporters.
How many reporters were there?
Well, it was just me at that point. Mm-hmm. But there were others coming and going all day long, I think. And I was given a briefing by him. And it was he made a kind of a very strong impression on me because he seemed both very cool and very distraught at the same time. I mean, he was tamped down as a person, but he was trying very hard to get across something that you could see he actually really believed strongly in, which was, in essence, that the U.S. was in danger. And he was saying Trump has compromising ties with the Russians, and they are playing games, and they are trying to interfere in your election, and they're trying to undo NATO, and they're trying to, break up the Western alliance. And this is really serious. And he had some details, but he was very careful guarding his sources. He didn't hand out any documents. He didn't distribute the dossier or anything. He didn't discuss it. It was difficult material to follow up on, but he was fascinating.
So as you left the Tabard Inn that day, what did you make of it and what did you do or not do?
Well, I felt I'm not a Russian expert, which is very clear. And that many of the sort of details of the Kremlinology was way beyond my area of expertise. So I think I alerted others at the magazine who knew more about Russia and said, there are these people who feel that they that something really insidious is going on, and maybe people who know more about Russia ought to meet with them. I continued to follow the story and write about the campaign and watch it closely. And I remembered him and just felt he seemed to be a fascinating character and someone who felt so strongly about things. And so later, when after Trump was elected and more came out about the ties between the Trump team and Russia, and eventually much more came out about the dossier, and he was described as a bad actor by the Trump defenders and someone who was a liar and somebody who was just out to get Trump. It didn't compute with the little glimpse I'd seen of him. I mean, he was barely talking about the election in terms of Hillary versus Trump. What he was interested in was geopolitics, and he was talking about the much larger picture of Russia's aims around the world, and particularly to sort of undermine Western democracies.
Now, somebody who's not a reporter is briefed about this in September of 2016, and that's the Secretary of State John Kerry. And this is months before Obama himself and Biden are briefed on it. Kerry is shown this by his aides, and he doesn't quite know what to make of it, and they put it back in their safe, and they don't speak of it again. And so far as I understand from my own conversations in that circle, John Kerry did not pick up the phone immediately and tell the President of the United States, which it seems incredible to me.
Well, you've got it was kind of incredible. And this was, again, Steele was talking to the State Department because he had connections there, too, from his years of working, as an ally in government. And he felt no one's paying attention. And somebody's, you know, he was sort of basically saying, the Russians are coming. But what happened inside the State Department is that they looked at his dossier as something that was a political document. And they backed away from it because there's a law that the Hatch Act that keeps people in government from getting involved in campaigns. It's to try to keep them separate from politics.
When do actual copies of the dossier start landing in the hands of some reporters around town? I never saw it for one, but I do know of people at other places that had it at a certain point. When was that?
You know, I'm not certain because it certainly we didn't get one at the New Yorker, and I think it was quite late in the game. Basically, you have to understand that Steele is somebody whose hair is on fire, but he's also someone who is accustomed to secrecy. And so he's trying to work through all the proper channels and not reveal secrets to the wrong people. So he'll tell the press some things, but he's not handing out copies of the dossier. He's not telling them what really would have been, I think, incendiary, which is that there's a growing FBI investigation into Trump's ties to Russia. So you've got this whole summer going on where the Clinton campaign is fending off accusations that Hillary Clinton is a crook who needs to be locked up and that the FBI is investigating her on again, off again, on again, off again. And meanwhile, nobody knows that there's actually a investigation by the FBI into Trump that's parallel. I mean, not nobody knows, a handful know.
But what intelligence people do know is that the Russians have tried to penetrate the Democratic National Committee, the emails of John Podesta. We know this. And somehow nobody's connecting the dots. And the administration is playing by the rules of the game, what you called in another media appearance, the old rules. Do you think they regret that now? Do you think the Obama people regret not being more proactive in various ways about Trump and about his potential connection to Russia?
I think some do, definitely. I mean, and there's been some self-criticism as well as criticism from the outside of the Obama administration. I mean, the things that Obama could have done that he didn't do were he could have gone public and made a speech of some sort and brought attention to it. And he never really did that. He had some of the heads of the intelligence agencies put out a statement, but he didn't make a speech himself. He was worried about doing anything again that would look political. So he was trying to get a bipartisan statement together with the heads of the leadership of the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress to sign, and the Republicans wouldn't sign on to it. And then he gave up kind of after that, it seems. So he was taking a really low-profile role as this sort of threat was growing.
The UK's intelligence service, the GCHQ, Domestic Intelligence, intercepted communications between Trump's team in Moscow that have not been made public. What's the likelihood that we're ever going to see these intercepts? Will they see the light of day?
You know, I doubt we'll see that, but I think what's going to happen, if I were betting, is that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, will have access to a lot of the intelligence and certainly everything in the FBI's investigation. And he will also have access to a lot of Christopher Steele's information because Steele has made an appearance in front of Mueller's investigators and told them pretty much everything he knows. So I think, you know, eventually we will be able to see how these dots do connect and where they do and where they don't.
During the transition, BuzzFeed decided to publish the Steele dossier, and it marked very clearly that this is not corroborated intelligence. But it was very controversial that Ben Smith, the editor of BuzzFeed, and his colleagues decided to publish this. How did you feel about that then, and how do you feel about it now?
So I actually supported his decision to publish it. And this would be something that would put me on the opposite side with Christopher Steele, who was very upset that it was published because it was never meant for the public to see it. What happened, the reasoning that it's a hard call. I mean, I can see the reasoning on both sides, but the reason that BuzzFeed went with it was by then it was known, because CNN had done a story, that President-elect Trump had been briefed on this document and that this document was salacious and explosive.
How did the President of the United States react to the dossier? He was briefed on it, and then later, I think the same day almost, Trump was briefed on it, maybe the next day. Apparently their reactions to this briefing were quite different.
Well, the President Obama at the time, apparently the people who were in the Oval Office found the dossier chilling. They hadn't really known the details of this alleged collusion between the Trump camp and Russia. And President Obama himself, though, was silent, didn't say anything right away. Vice President Biden said and turned to Comey, who was briefing them, and said, is this serious? Is this for real? And Comey said that they regarded Steele as a reliable source. They knew a lot of his sources and subsources, and that they regarded his network as reliable, and that they had not corroborated the dossier, but they had come up with independent information that was consistent with it.
Now, these are, in fairness, Western intelligence agencies and agents who have made colossal errors in the past. We needn't go through the list. So to what degree should we to this day be dubious of it or think that it's true? I mean, our reflexes of doubt run pretty deep for many of us.
Sure. I mean, and I think that's healthy to be skeptical about a lot of this. But what's happened over time, and it's been 18 months now since Steele started out writing his dossier, and what you've been able to see is that there have been more, sort of this trickle of disclosures that have come out. There was actually a meeting, believe it or not, in Trump Tower, where the Trump team, including the president's son and his son-in-law, met with a Russian. You know, it sort of begins to check off the little ticks in the boxes, and it seems like there are more and more of what Steele said seems backed up. There's plenty that's not still. There's lots we don't know. But I talked to a number of intelligence officials, and there are three of them named on the record in this story, who say that every day the dossier seems a little stronger.
To what degree does this dossier shape the Mueller investigation of the Trump administration?
I don't know. You know, Mueller is a black box. They famously don't leak. It's really hard to know. But what you can see is that there are four members of the Trump team who Mueller has now indicted, and three of them have pled guilty and are cooperating with him. And so, and these are people, several of whom are named in the Steele dossier. So it seems as if there's something beyond just smoke. There's a little bit of fire there, we've seen.
Now, my understanding is that Christopher Steele has been interviewed by Mueller and his fellow investigators. Do we know how much material he gave the special counsel?
We don't know, because neither Steele nor Mueller talk. But the people who know Steele well say, given how seriously he takes this subject, that he likely shared an awful lot of what he knows.
What's next for Christopher Steele?
He is working on some other secret project now, and I don't know what it is, but it's some other big case. And, trying to get his life back together. And I think he'd like his reputation back. It took a huge hit because he's been made such a target by the defenders of Trump.
You know, everybody I talk to in Washington says what you say about the Mueller investigation being a black box, and there's no evidence to disbelieve that. But I'm sure you must get this question all the time, whether it's in the grocery store or in the office or wherever. Where do you think this is headed, Jane? How does this end?
So, you know, I don't know. And I try to just stay a reporter and not be a soothsayer. But I have to say, when I started this story, I really didn't know what to make of the whole sort of Russian scandal and whether it was for real or not. And I've put a couple months into this story now. And I have to say, there are so many strange connections between the Trump team and Russia that it just seems to me there's something going on there. It may not, I don't know if it goes beyond potentially Manafort, who's been charged, and the people that he was working with, or Carter Page, potentially. It's hard to tell, but there is a lot going on between the Trump team and Russia.
The article, and it's a remarkable one, even though I know I'm prejudiced, is called The Man Behind the Dossier, and the reporter and author is Jane Mayer. Jane, thanks so much.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you.